The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Put your head, jump out of bed, cause we're turning up the light. Yeah, it's time to awaken, waitress, start a bacon, Broadway's back tonight. Hey, New York, time to pop your cork, cause the future's looking bright.
The Tony Awards last weekend was quite a different event than in previous years. But a year and a half after the pandemic, Broadway is coming back, albeit with vaccination cards and masks and forehead thermometers, and of course, sanitizer by the handful. Shows that closed in March of 2020 are now reopening. New shows are having their premieres. And the Broadway season is quite unusual in another way as well. It will feature seven plays written by Black playwrights, and believe it or not, that's a record. Vincent Cunningham and Alexandra Schwartz both write about theater for The New Yorker.
Everything has changed so much. I mean, so have you been to the theater lately? You know, have you dipped a toe in yet?
I've been to several shows. A couple things off Broadway. The first Broadway thing I saw was Passover by Antoinette Nwandu, and it was really, really, excited in there. People were, you know, doing their woos and claps and stuff before the curtain even came up. It was like a sort of, everybody was really excited to be back. How about you? Have you been back in the seat yet?
I've been back in the seat in kind of the lowest key way. The only thing I have seen so far, and this is all about to change, but I went to the Hunter College's theater to see What Happened, Richard Nelson's final play in his Rhinebeck panorama. And yes, you know, visceral feelings of anxiety encountering fellow human beings in a small space. And that moment when someone coughs and everyone kind of seizes up. And this theater has, I don't know exactly how many seats, but I'd be willing to say fewer than 100. And, you know, I think I cried at least three times during that play, which I might have anyway. I love Richard Nelson. Yeah. And what he was working with specifically in this play is this sense of presence, of being with other people. The play, as many of his plays do, takes place around a kitchen table, and it is about being in community with other people. That feeling was really strong, and that reminded me of what we have been missing with the theaters closed. And Vincent, you know, I'm just wondering, we're about to get back into the seats. We're about to be in and out of theaters constantly over the next few months. What strikes you about this season, looking at what's on deck?
Well, you know, but I think, and we've talked about this before, I think that there's always a tension on Broadway between things that want to be kind of serious and intellectual and literary and things that present themselves more as entertainment. It's funny because the first thing back, and I talked about this in my review just a bit, was Passover, which is was a funny thing to be a first thing back because, you know, Broadway is back comes with these like jazz hands that makes me think about like Aladdin the musical or whatever. And instead it was this downbeat meditation on like police violence and Black alienation and lots of other themes like that. And so it did seem like a bit of an uncomfortable fit. And then, you know, on the other hand, literally Aladdin the musical is in fact back. So, you know.
Yeah, you know, I'm just looking at plays like Is This a Room, which is the whistleblower Reality Winner's arrest by the FBI, her interrogation and her arrest by the FBI, and dramatizes it without straying from the transcript that is available to us.
Okay. Is your dog friendly?
Okay, so she does not like men.
Okay. That's a problem.
However, and she might come towards you, but she's not aggressive. She's never bitten anybody. She's just got, you know, a really good growl going. She'll probably just hide under my desk.
Okay. Do you have a leash or something where we could... Okay.
I get her leashed up.
So what we might want to do is maybe let...
And I'm also just glancing at the calendar right now, looking ahead. And one thing that sticks out to me is Diana, the Princess Diana musical.
Pretty as we've ever seen, like a living magazine. We'll be proud to call you queen. Oh.
And just like that, they fell in love.
So the contrast between, you know, a play about the arrest of Reality Winner and a play about Princess Diana, a musical about Princess Diana, I'm very curious about how audiences will react and also who the audiences are going to be. You know, presumably you have the diehard Broadway heads who want to show up and see stuff. But I wonder, you know, if the Diana audience member is also going to be the Is This a Room audience member.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. And, you know, disproportionately, the sort of Diana the musical side of it is peopled by tourists. And who knows how they're going to show up and what their place in all this will be, what tourism numbers will continue to look like as the season winds on. But I feel, you know, fairly certain that the tourist is not going to be, you know, psyched for Reality Winner.
Are there other things you're particularly looking forward to?
Well, yeah, looking forward, I'm always excited. Well, there are two new Lynn Nottage plays that I'm looking forward to, each in its own way. One is called Clydes, which will star one of my favorite actors these days, Uzo Aduba. I've been watching a lot of the show in treatment and really enjoying her work. But then on the other hand, and who knows what that will hold. For me, new Lynn Nottage is always a good time. But the other thing, which I think also brings this entertainment thing into view, is she's doing a Michael Jackson musical, which, you know, there are many things that could be brought up in connection with Michael Jackson. Of course, there's a version that is not so great that elides all of these things that could happen, but I'm hoping against hope that... it will reveal itself, as you mentioned, to sort of walk that thin line between art and entertainment.
Me too. That is a fascinating project. And yeah, it's sort of like, you know, it seems like gold for a jukebox musical, what's not to love about the music, but the story and the ethical reality of dealing with a figure like Michael Jackson is, you know, it's quite complex and tricky. I really wonder what we're going to get with that one.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that everybody is talking about these days, the great big capital E everybody, is the proliferation of Black written shows on Broadway. I believe that there, 7 was the number we kept on hearing, and now that Slave Play is coming back, I guess you have to call it 8. Slave Play by Jeremy O'Harris. I wonder, Alex, do you think that this means something new in the future? Do you think it solves problems or poses new ones? What does that number mean to you?
That's such a good question. You know, the ultimate answer is we're not going to know until we see the plays, because we have no idea what these plays are going to be like. You know, will they be good? Will they be middling? Will they be not great? Who knows? I think the fact of more diversity on Broadway can only be good, because Broadway is like a slow moving cruise ship. It wants to appeal to its familiar audience. Its audience is by and large older, by and large whiter than the New York mean, certainly. And I think, you know, in moments like this where the season was just wiped clean by COVID, it clearly has given producers and theaters a new opening to try some new things and to bring some new voices to Broadway. I think that's really important. I think it's really important for the ecosystem of Broadway, for the theater in general. I mean, if Broadway is just a crowd-pleasing, tried and true entertainment device, yeah, that works for some of the things we need to work for tourism, for industry, et cetera. But as a creative field, not so much. I think the concern is what often happens when, you know, underrepresented groups are brought in. You know, it reminds me of the phenomenon of like when you hire a female CEO for your company just before the company takes, you know, is this an honest attempt? And I really hope it is. You know, what no one wants us to be is a cynical optics attempt. And then we don't see another really diverse Broadway season for the next 30 years. I'm going in and approaching it with a lot of optimism and with just the usual curiosity I have for any new show. How about you? What are you thinking about it?
Yeah, on the level of each individual play, I feel the exact same way. It's always like, go and see what happens, right? Go and see what the play does to you. You can only bring so much sociology with you into the scene, right? But for me, the big thing is, yes, like seeing whether this is a lasting change on the side of the selection of the plays, but also I think to the extent that it is a pressing opportunity in the now, it is how do you start to use this to be sort of, how do you use it to change what the audiences look like? How do you sort of turn Broadway, flawed as it is, into a vehicle for like small D democracy, which is like what the theater is supposed to be about.
Broadway lives and dies by who goes to see the plays. And it would be fascinating and fantastic if we could get a wider range of audience member. How amazing would it be if, in the best case scenario that I can see, is that Broadway's return to New York City a bit and to the people of New York. So that could be something very cool.
I do wonder if the movie version of Dear Evan Hansen will drive a new wave of people to that show too, which I have another thing that I have not seen. I have not been found in the seats of Evan Hansen. I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing, you know, now we're talking about all these exciting genre breaking new Broadway shows. Actually, I would like to kind of go around and see a lot of the musicals that have been around for a while that I have missed. Dear Evan Hansen is definitely at the top of my list. I haven't seen The Lion King since I went with my parents and my younger cousin, I want to say in the year 2003. Is that possible?
That's possible, yeah.
You know, let's go see The Lion King. Would you like to go with me?
Let's go see The Lion King. Yep. Let's do
great.
It.
Vincent Cunningham and Alexandra Schwartz are staff writers and critics for The New Yorker. Now, this week is The New Yorker Festival, our 22nd annual celebration with guests like Merrick Garland, Letitia James, Stanley Tucci, Amy Schumer, Jane Goodall, and Kara Walker. And there are live events, too, featuring Billie Eilish, Dave Grohl, Amy Mann, and more. You can find out more about the New Yorker Festival at newyorker.com/festival. That's newyorker.com/festival. And there's more to come today, too, on the New Yorker Radio Hour, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite, Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Mama!
You've been on my mind! How are you? Tell me everything.
Well, I'm tired, but I am happy. It has been, you know, like a violent sort of reimagination of life as I know it. It's insane. I mean, parenthood is insane.
Yeah, I've heard that.
She's sleeping now. She said a quick hello earlier.
She's sleeping? What do you, a little bourbon helps or something?
Yeah, a little whiskey in the bottle.
The other day, I caught up with our music critic, Amanda Petrusich, and I hadn't seen her in quite a while. Amanda, I feel like I'm breaking into your house. You're on leave with a new baby. We miss you in our pages and pixels, but I know it'll come again soon. And apparently you're playing music, as a good music critic should, for your baby, Nico.
I am indeed.
So give us the playlist.
It's such an overwhelming idea, I think, for any parent, but especially for a music critic who perhaps sort of fancies herself a connoisseur of sound, to say like, oh my God, it's this blank slate. Like, you've never heard anything. Like, it's as if an alien has, you know, just landed on Earth, and you get to kind of introduce them to the sort of magnitude of, you know, popular music and sound. And so that's intimidating. I think at first it was like, God, I need to play things for her, you know, just the greatest recordings ever made. But I pretty quickly kind of loosened my grip on that idea and just wanted songs that we could be happy listening to together, songs that we could share, and she would be excited and I would be excited. And, you know, by the time the thing was over, we would both be really smiling and happy. It was funny. I mean, so many of the songs I've been playing her are from like the late 60s, early 70s, as if I'm raising a boomer baby. But I think that music is kind of comfort food for me. You know, it's stuff that just sounds really good and sounds really right and easy. I have to say, and I don't know, David, where you kind of are on the Lennon-McCartney spectrum, but for me, I've always thought Paul McCartney might be the kind of greatest chronicler of domestic bliss within the rock and roll canon. I mean, historically, not a very popular topic for rock songwriters. But McCartney, I think, is kind of a total savant when it comes to this particular strain of sentimentality. And so one of my favorite records from his solo career is Ram, which he and Linda released in 1971. And it's really an album, I think, about having a baby.
I know that McCartney's, you know, post-Beatles reputation's had ups and downs, but I think he's kind of proud of Ram.
I think he is, too. It's a beautiful record, and I think, you know, really captures like that sort of gooey, kind of pie-eyed, like exhausted but so in love period that follows having a baby.
Yeah.
I look high, I look low, I'm looking everywhere I go. Looking for a home in the heart of the country.
So Nico loves Heart of the Country, which is a song from Ram, which I play for her almost every morning. And it also contains the very relevant line, I'm going to get me a good night's sleep. Still a bit of a pipe dream at the moment. it's a song, I mean, I think much of Ram has this kind of vibe, but it has an almost nursery rhyme sort of feel to it. Her whole face just lights up. She does this incredibly goofy open mouth grin. It's like, you know, it's like the sun has just risen in the sky for the first time ever. And no matter how many times I play it for her, the reaction is the same. She's just so unbelievably stoked to hear it. I wanna give me a good night's sleep. One thing I've learned in these first few months as a parent is that babies require a lot of rocking and jiggling and bouncing. Nico really loves to be danced around the room, and one of our favorite songs, and a song I was especially excited to play for her in those kind of giddy early days when I was so happy but so tired, is Rocksteady by Aretha Franklin. Single from Young, Gifted, and Black, a record Franklin released in 1972 that I still think is one of the greatest soul records of all time. You actually cannot be tired while listening to Rocksteady, so it can't help me. Yeah, right? I mean, it's sort of instant caffeine. It's like a shot in the arm. I have to say, pop music is really great to sing to babies, as you know, because of just how many instances of the word baby appear in these songs. You know, she's convinced they're all about her.
What's your third pick?
So my daughter is named Nico, and in 1967, the Velvet Underground, one of my all-time favorite bands, released an album featuring a German singer, model, actress named Nico. My daughter wasn't named after her exactly, but I've always loved the name, which evokes for me a kind of deeply effortless cool. It's a quality I do not possess, but that I hope perhaps my child will one day grow into. And one of my favorite songs off the Velvet Underground and Nico is probably also one of the most sentimental things Lou Reed ever wrote. It's a track called I'll Be Your Mirror.
It's good to have a song by a complete heroin addict.
I know. When I was playing this for her early on, my husband would be like, are you sure this song isn't about heroin? The fact is, I'm not sure. But a sweet song. I think, you know, Lou, probably a softie at heart. So let me go ahead and play you a little bit. And I've always thought the first verse of this song is a pretty good encapsulation of what a parent's job is. Kind of helping someone see how magnificent they are when perhaps that idea has been obscured to them.
I'll be your mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I'll be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door, to show that you're home. When you think the night has in your mind.
It's wonderful to see you.
Yeah, likewise.
I wish for you and Nico and everyone at your house nothing but peace and good health and a good night's sleep, too.
Thank you so much, David.
Take care.
'Cause I see you.
Amanda Petrusich is a staff writer, and her last piece for us before Nico was born was a tribute to the late Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones. Amanda's new parent playlist includes Heart of the Country by Paul and Linda McCartney, Rocksteady by Aretha Franklin, and I'll Be Your Mirror from the Velvet Underground and Nico.
I find it hard to believe you don't know.
So corny. Being a parent makes you so corny. I'm embarrassing my daughter, and she's only 3 months old. It's already happening. I'm sorry, Nico. Your mom is a dork.
When you think the night is in your mind, that inside you.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Your eyes, hand to your darkness, so you won't be afraid when you think the night has in your mind.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of Poetry Unbound by Padre Gotuma, a poetry anthology that offers immersive reflections, keen insights, and personal anecdotes on 50 powerful poems. Focusing on poets mainly writing today, Poetry Unbound engages with a diverse array of voices that includes Ada Limon, Ilya Kaminsky, Margaret Atwood, Ocean Vuong, Layli Long Soldier, and Reginald Dwayne Betts. Poetry Unbound is now in paperback.